Hi there, Dr. B here with your modules 3 and 4 for clarifying lecture. I'll start with the announcements, talk about your behaviors bio, inner teaching module 3, inner teaching module 4, and then we didn't have any questions today, so I won't be answering any, I guess. All right, so announcements. I want to start with your behaviors bio draft. This is just a draft. It doesn't have to be in its final form. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to have everything answer perfectly. It is just enough for your peer reviewer to be able to have something to give feedback on. That's all you have to do. So put together something that can make sure that your reviewer has enough to give you feedback with. Make sure that you're doing that with both the presentation and the paper. These are pretty easy points. As long as you've done something, you're probably going to get all the points. So make sure that you have just enough for people to review and give you feedback on. You can always make changes. Most of you are keeping up really nicely with the ABA sets. Good work. It looks like you, whatever strategy y'all are using is working. I did run a quick user report last week. It looks like most of you are spending about the recommended 8 to 10 hours on the course. So it looks like you're doing nicely. Stay the course. Things I noticed on your annotated bibliography. First things first. So APA style is important. And why is it? Oh my gosh, you know, there's this, there's caps, there's italics, you know, what's going on? So think about it this way. The APA style was designed to make sure two things. The first is that whatever work other people have had, they get credit for. So if you're taking something, paraphrasing something from another source, you're saying, hey, I got it from there. And this is the stuff that I got from there. So in-text citations are just as important as the bibliography. The other thing that APA style does is if you want to go read that thing that I took this stuff from, here's where to get it. So those are the two things that APA style does. That's what they function as. It functions as a standardized way to give credit and also to be able to go back to the source if needed. So you might be feeling like APA style is a bit of a, you know, exercise in, you know, pedantics or, you know, who cares, you know, just the professors. That's what APA style is for. And if you're wondering, yes, I have cited things using APA style in treatment plans. And I think you probably will too, if you're adhering to our science and evidence-based practice. The next thing that I expect you to do is define technical terms. Even if you know what a functional analysis is, even if you've done functional analyses out the wazoo, I still want you to describe what it is. Two reasons. First, if you're describing it in your own words, I can get a gauge as to whether or not you have a correct understanding of what the concept or principle or procedure is. Second, you'll practice how to explain these things to other people who aren't behaviorists. So they're not going to know what stimulus equivalence is using matrix training, for example. You will have to describe that to your non-behavioral peers. Here's a place to practice that. All right, that's it for behaviorist bio. Looking forward to those drafts. You are free to sign up for your peer review partner, but peer reviews will not be due until the end of Module 6. All right, inner teaching Module 3. So first things first, and we talk about this in Inner Teaching Module 4, I want you to understand that what you're learning are not interventions. They're not things we do to people, okay? They are the phenomena under which the world works. So reinforcement, for example. Reinforcement happens to me, it happens to you, it happens to my corgi over here, it happens to the kids you work with, it happens to the parents you work with. If you're a sentient being, these things are happening. They're not things that we apply to children. Now, once we understand the phenomena, can we work with it to help change behavior? Yeah, absolutely. That's what ABA as a therapy is about. The ABA as a philosophy, as a phenomena, as a science, says that all of these laws, all these things that you're learning, all fit within what we know about human behavior. So it's basically, why do people do the things that they do? Why do organisms do the things that they do? Okay. Number three, I think a lot of people were trying to fit square pegs into round holes. So this is a complex schedule. So you've got the CRF, because everything, every time you go past, and if you're going to speed limit, there's a sign that comes up. So you've got the CRF there. That's for reinforcement. I believe you could say that there's a CRF in place for punishment too, because every time you go through and, you know, you're above the speed limit, you get a ticket. So you got two CRFs going, and then the lottery itself is a VR schedule. Okay, so you've got a lot of things going on all at the same time, and those things can all happen all at the same time. In fact, most of the time, we're operating and our clients are operating under complex schedules. We are not operating on a VR or a VI or a CRF exclusively. So that's something to keep in mind. I talk about this and also relational framing as we have cascading networks going on of all kinds of reinforcement schedules as we speak, and all those things are maintaining our behavior. And that as interventionists, we probably only have a good understanding of and the ability to change maybe even a small piece of that. So that's important to understand. I'm still seeing reward and reinforcer being interchangeable. Remember that reward is something nice and pretty. Reinforcer strengthens. Reinforce, strengthen. It's going to happen again. You can't use these terms interchangeably. I know that sometimes BALC uses these terms interchangeably, but I want to caution you against it. Again, this sounds like, okay, Dr. Barthold, you know, ivory tower professor, who cares? But it's more than that. So we've been kind of fast and loose on terms occasionally. Things like, you know, stimulus control, we think we're in control, or instructional control is us being able to control the instructions, all those type of things. And none of that is actually true to behavior analytic philosophy. We've said things like, take what they like to get you what you want. I've seen that in videos to describe reinforcement. Or that, you know, we're using things that they like to control their behavior. You can see where if somebody was critical of behavior analysis, that they might latch on to that and say, whoa, changing people, reinforcing people, changing people, trying to take control of the situation, controlling and manipulating people, using what they like to get what you want, sounds a heck of a lot like gaslighting. And none of these things have anything to do with the actual application of behavior analysis. And so I think sometimes that maybe we created our own problems in that we didn't use our terms carefully enough. And therefore, now we're running into trouble because people are interpreting what we said to mean that we want to control and gaslight and manipulate and change people. And we're absolutely not in that business. So something to keep in mind. Reinforcement does not require awareness, perception, or cognition to work. If it did, then one of my colleagues could not use behavior analysis on planaria. And they do, or they did before they retired. It does not require any type of cognition. All it is, this is all reinforcement is a relationship between a consequence and a behavior that strengthens the probability that the behavior will happen again. We don't have to like it. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to realize it. We don't have to do any of that. And in fact, all that stuff we consider explanatory fiction. It doesn't have to be nice. It doesn't have to be pretty. Okay? It's just a relationship between a response and a consequence. And that's it. You know, again, I'm seeing people reinforcing people. Again, if you, you know, reinforce people, you're changing people. I want to talk a little bit about reinforcement not being motivating. So motivating operation is an antecedent that creates a condition in which a reinforcer might be stronger or weaker, but reinforcement itself cannot be motivating. Okay, so again, this is one of these things, and even in 622, when we get, you know, the person who wrote the book being extremely precise in his language, he still says sometimes reinforcement is motivating. And remember that motivating operations are antecedents and that reinforcers are consequences. Let's talk a little bit about schedules of reinforcement. Some of you were mixing up variable interval with variable time and differential reinforcement. So in a VI schedule, the first response after the passage of time is reinforced. So it does not matter what happens within that time interval. So some of you were saying, oh, if they set appropriately for 10 minutes, then you deliver the reinforcer. That's differential reinforcement. If you're trying to, I'll tell the story of the individual that I work with who spent a lot of time in the bathroom. And that I would set a timer and say, okay, you know, you went to the bathroom. It's reasonable to say that, you know, you don't have to go again in 5 minutes. So I'm setting a timer for 5 minutes. If you ask to go to the bathroom after that 5 minutes, I'll let you go. But during that 5 minute time, no, you got to stay here. And, you know, again, you know, looking at people's, you know, dignity and ethics and things like that, I'm not going to, you know, say, oh, you got to sit here for an hour or something like that. But if someone's asking to go to the bathroom, come back, ask to go to the bathroom, come back, ask to go to the bathroom, and we've ruled out any things like neurogenic bladder or bladder infections or things like that, you know, you can settle, you know, a VI schedule for that type of thing. Another idea of a VI schedule with a limited hold would be something to the effect of, if you've ever listened to the radio and they say, okay, you know, the contest is open. If you call now, the first 5 callers will win movie tickets. So there's a time period, a window in which reinforcement is available. That's your limited hold. Or for example, if you've ever waited online and refreshed your page until you could buy a ticket to a show you really wanted to go to, that's a VI schedule. It doesn't matter what you do until that window is open. Okay, so think about it that way. The window has to be open for the behavior to be reinforced. In a VT schedule, no response is required. Okay, so if I use a variable time schedule, for example, and I do, approximately every 2 minutes, I go over and say, are you doing okay? And it doesn't really matter what the individual is doing. That would be a VT schedule, okay? And that's also called non-contingent reinforcement. I would like to talk a little bit about the difference between behavior analysts and analysts. So analysts tend to be Freudian. So there are the people who sit there, you know, their clients on the couch and take notes and look for insights and all those types of things. That's what an analyst does. A behavior analyst analyzes behavior. Two different things. Please do not call yourself an analyst. And the last thing is talking about mentalism. So mentalism is when we are ascribing a cognitive cause for behavior. I'm mad, so I. They're seeking attention. They want this. This makes you happy and that's why you're doing it. We don't know. I have no idea what you seek. I have no idea if you're happy or not. I can't confirm these independently. I can go by what you say. I can go by your facial expressions. I'm making educated guesses, which you may or may not confirm. And if you're confirming them, are you lying to me or not? I don't know. You know, do you even know if you're lying? You don't. So that's why we avoid mentalistic explanations, okay? And they can kind of roll into what we call explanatory fictions. So I saw some people say sensory needs. So we don't talk about sensory needs in behavior analysis, first because There's not a lot of evidence to support it. There's a little bit growing, I will say that. But there's not necessarily evidence to support that. Also, we don't know what somebody needs sensorily. Okay, so sensory sensation, you'll learn this in 622, is just perceiving information. That's all sensory systems do. So do those sensory systems have needs? I don't know. Okay. So we stay away from that. We don't talk about attention seeking behavior. We say attention maintained because we don't know what somebody's seeking. I saw some people saying that, you know, response cost was punishment or X intervention is punishment. And I want to say that's a little bit of a misnomer because reinforcement and punishment can only be determined based on the frequency of the future behavior, not what the contingency looks like. So let's say, for example, if you said punching somebody in the gut is a positive punisher. This seems reasonable on the surface. What if I told you that I pay good money to go somewhere where occasionally people punch me in the gut? Yeah. Okay. Now what if I told you I'm a second degree black belt? Do you see why you can't say X is Y without looking at how is it affecting the response? Okay. So you have to look at the effects of a phenomena in order to understand whether or not it's reinforcing or punishing. Remember that there are no such thing as punishments because punishment is a process, not a product. Okay, so we would say punisher, not punishments. And this is a common error that I seem to be myth busting even up to the very last course in our 7-course sequence. Consequences can be either reinforcing or punishing. And you probably have a long learning history that says that, you know, give them consequences, and consequences being synonymous with punishment. Okay. But they're not the same. Okay. Consequences can be reinforcing if they increase responding. Consequences can be punishing if they decrease responding. They're just events that happen after a behavior occurs. That's all they are in behavior analysis. Don't read too far into it. Again, you can't punish people. You can only punish responses. Go back to, you know, what I talked about earlier for that. The prisoner thing. A lot of people said, you know, it sounds like a good thing. And then some of you said also it could be a little coercive. So in 623, you're going to read a whole book on coercion and the ethical use of reinforcement and punishment in society, and also how it kind of is already used in society. It's going to be called Coercion and Its Fallout, and it's written by Murray Sidman, where he's going to talk a lot about how reinforcement can be used as coercion and how punishment can be used as coercion. So stay tuned for some of that. I did want to talk a little bit about rule governance versus contingency-shaped behavior. So rules do not have to be laws, and they don't have to be written. They don't necessarily even have to be spoken. But they are verbal behavior that has control over another behavior. So, for example, don't touch a hot stove. You don't have to come in contact with the contingency for the rule to form. Sometimes you come in contact with the contingency the first time around, and a really strong rule will form. So, for example, let's say if you wear something, you get made fun of. Let's say you're wearing, stripes with plaid. And someone goes, oh my gosh, you are wearing stripes with plaid. Oh my gosh, I cannot believe it. That may form a rule that says we never wear stripes with plaid. And even when stripes with plaid comes back into fashion, most likely you're going to be like, uh-uh, not me. I don't wear stripes with plaid. I have a rule. Okay, so that's rule governance. Contingency shaped is just, you know, behavior happens. It's either reinforced or punished. And that's what you do. So if a behavior is reinforced, you're more likely to do something again. If it's punished, you're more likely to do something different that will then be negatively reinforced because you're avoiding that punisher. Okay. So hopefully that helps to clarify that a little bit. Want to talk about extinction. I used to work in a program where if you wanted to use extinction, you also had to have in your plan every single contingency about the side effects. So if you wanted to use extinction with a client, you had to plan for your extinction burst, you had to plan for spontaneous recovery, you had to plan for any type of residual or inductive responses, or the plan was not approved by the administration. I also want you to think about extinction as not a reductive procedure. So yes, extinction reduces responding by cutting off that response reinforcer relationship. But that doesn't mean that we always have extinction as a program. So it doesn't mean that we're always going, okay, we're going to use extinction now and it only is for problem behavior. I gave this example when I was doing a presentation for a school. And I said, okay, how many of you have done a behavior plan that was amazing? Kid responded really, really well to it. Everything was great. And people said, you know what? This kid doesn't need it anymore. We're going to stop doing this. Okay. We have now cut off the response reinforcer relationship. Well, kind of inadvertently, not, you know, in the way that we would quote unquote want to do that. So now what's going to happen? Well, we're going to see an extinction burst. So appropriate behavior is going to burst. And that will reinforce our decision. Look, he's better than ever. Might even try some new things along the way. You know, that inductive responding. Whoa, you know, we knew this behavior plan was just stifling, you know, this kid. And, you know, he's better than ever. This is fantastic. And then the burst crashes and problem behavior resurges. So I want you to think about this in terms of that extinction can happen to any behavior. It doesn't have to be an inappropriate behavior. It can totally be an appropriate one too. One of the groups asked, can facial expressions be punishers? Oh, yes, they can. So I made the example that my mother, I'm convinced that The Rock got the people's eyebrow from my mother. The Rock did live in my hometown, so possible. But what my mom would do is that she'd go, oh my goodness, whatever we were doing, we stopped. Whatever we were saying, we stopped. And, you know, to the day she passed away and I was in my mid-30s, this was very effective punisher. So yes, facial expressions can absolutely be reinforcers and punishers. And so why do we always talk about differentially reinforcing an appropriate behavior when we're using a reductive procedure? The reason is because, and some of you hit this nail on the head, is that if you're suppressing one response, that we'll have inductive responses. So we'll have other behaviors that are, you know, varied and then selected based on their reinforcers. So if I don't intentionally teach an appropriate behavior to replace a behavior that I am attempting to reduce or extinguish. Remember, you can only extinguish behavior using extinction. Everything else is just reduction. We're kind of playing what I tell parents is whack-a-mole, that, you know, you get rid of one, something else pops up, you got to whack that mole. Well, then something else comes up, you whack that mole. By the way, I'm not endorsing whacking children or using any type of physical punishment procedures or aversive control. Not talking about that, but just using this as a metaphor. So if we teach an appropriate response that replaces, we save a lot of time. So I'm talking a lot about being very strict with our terms and things like that. you know, do keep in mind that, you know, a little bit of this is like, you know, translating, you know, one language to another. The way we talk to parents is different than the way we talk to each other as professionals. But I do think it is important for you to learn these concepts and principles very strictly so that when it comes to application, number one, you're applying them appropriately. And number two, when you're talking about them, that you're making sure you're staying faithful to really what the concepts and principles of behavior analysis are. All right, so thank you very much for listening, and I will see you in Module 5.